Did you know a terrorist entity set up a crowdfunding website on the dark web to help other terrorists finance sniper rifles, pickup vehicles, and computer equipment?
Cryptocurrencies such as bitcoins have long been popular among the far right.
And bitcoins don't guarantee privacy. All of your transactions and current balance are visible to anyone in the world.
This is Tech Against Terrorism.
I'm Adam Hadley.
And I'm Laurent Bodo.
In this episode, we'll talk about terrorist financing, and in particular, how terrorist financing works in a digital space. We'll take a closer look at cryptocurrencies and fintech platforms, and see to what extent terrorist organizations have exploited these so far. Today, we're joined by three leading experts in this field who'll shed light on these issues.
Terrorists require money to operate and sustain. Without it, they cannot purchase equipment, weapons, supplies, services, or even sustain their organization as a whole. Terrorist financing refers to the process of raising money through licit or illicit methods, as well as storing and moving these funds for terrorist purposes.
Licit methods could include the use of legitimate businesses. In 2001, for example, the New York Times reported that American officials had evidence that Osama bin Laden had used a network of shops to sell honey. Illicit methods, on the other hand, could include drug trafficking and selling counterfeit goods to finance terrorist operations, as in the case of the 2004 Madrid train bombings.
According to Colin P. Clark's House Financial Services Committee testimony in 2018, ISIS is, or was, the wealthiest terrorist organization in history. At the height of its territorial control in 2015, ISIS is said to have generated over $6 billion from three primary sources. First, oil and gas. Second, taxation and extortion. And finally, the 2014 looting of Mosul, a city in Iraq. How much money remains in the hands of ISIS is still unclear.
Counterterrorism finance, or CTF for short, focuses primarily on following the money through bank accounts while detecting and preventing suspicious transactions that could be used to support or enable terrorist operations. The success of CTF strategies, however, has raised concerns that terrorist groups might exploit digital currencies and cryptocurrencies instead in order to evade these measures. The reason for this is that no company and no government can intervene and stop the flow of decentralized peer-to-peer cryptocurrencies and crypto assets.
When looking at the extreme right's use of cryptocurrencies, the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, has been monitoring over 200 Bitcoin addresses belonging to prominent right-wing extremists, including the founder of the neo-Nazi website Daily Stormer, and other violent extremist terrorist groups such as Cyber-Nazi Atomwaffendivision or white nationalist Richard Spencer, who once said, "Bitcoin is the currency of the alt-right." According to the SPLC, the extreme right were early adopters of cryptocurrencies, and many of them have made a fortune after the Bitcoin price skyrocketed in 2017.
This year, the RAND Corporation published a report titled "Terrorist Use of Cryptocurrencies." The report examined the possibility of more widespread adoption of cryptocurrency by terrorist organizations. It concludes by saying, "Concerns about the use of cryptocurrency to enable terrorist activities have yet to manifest. However, coming improvements in cryptocurrency technologies will likely have a significant long-term effect on terrorism finance." Joining us now is Nick Furnow. He's the author of Investigating Cryptocurrencies, the only book that has been published so far on investigative techniques for researching cryptocurrencies. Nick, thanks very much for joining us today.
That's a pleasure.
So, first of all, what are cryptocurrencies?
Wow, that's an extremely broad question. If you break it down into the two parts, crypto comes from the term cryptography. And of course, a currency is the ability to move value and asset around the place. So it is essentially a pseudo-currency that is protected by cryptographic standards. Actually, it's quite just the term currency is interesting. Arguably, we don't really have any mainstream cryptocurrencies yet. If you think of a currency being able to, you know, pop across the road and buy yourself a coffee, you still can't do that with the mainstream cryptocurrencies. So we sort of prefer the term crypto assets, actually, because they are an asset. They do have a perceived value. But as yet, we don't really have a currency in the truest sense of the word.
Okay, so crypto assets, what an interesting concept. How do people use crypto assets?
At the moment, most of the use is investment. So if we're looking at numbers of people, then what you're looking at are people saying, oh, Bitcoin looks cool, and it was worth £20,000 in 2017, maybe it's worth throwing some money in there. So if you're looking at the general population, people are using cryptocurrency as investment. However, if we broaden that out to cryptocurrencies such as XRP, otherwise known as Ripple, well, that is being used for traditional money movement. So I want to move some money across the world, I can use XRP to do that. And that is perhaps the most widely used cryptocurrency for sort of money movement, traditional money movement.
And in terms of security and intelligence entities that might be interested in the terrorist use of crypto assets and cryptocurrency, what role does Ripple play and similar types of crypto assets and cryptocurrencies?
Well, cryptocurrencies like Ripple are very heavily, they play ball with law enforcement because you have a central point of ownership with cryptocurrencies such as Ripple. So they're not great for terrorists. They're not great for criminals to use. Criminals want to be using the open source, the distributed ledger type cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin, or the more secure type of cryptocurrencies such as Dash or Monero or Zcash. Things like Ripple are not great for the criminal community.
So in terms of Bitcoin and similar technologies, how are we seeing terrorists use those?
Well, that is the million Bitcoin question. We are seeing terrorist use of cryptocurrencies, but not yet to a significant degree. Europol back in 2017 suggested there was no major evidence of terrorist use. We've just seen the RAND white paper on terrorism funding with the use of cryptocurrencies also suggesting that there is not significant use. There are a number of reasons for that you might want to go into. So it's not that it's not happening. And certainly law enforcement needs to be gearing up for it because it will come. Criminals go where the money is. But there's a number of reasons at the moment why terrorism funding and isn't hugely using cryptocurrencies at the moment.
And what do you think would need to change?
Well, again, that is the million Bitcoin question. So there are concerns that criminals have over anonymity because they're hearing about people using things like Bitcoin, being arrested, having their assets seized. They're concerned about that. We have issues over acceptance. Let me give you a good example of that. So Bitcoin, even though Bitcoin is perhaps a less secure cryptocurrency, you've got about 13,500 transactions an hour going through Bitcoin. So that increases its anonymity, if you like. Whereas if you look at Zcash, which is a very, very anonymous cryptocurrency, there's only about 140, 150 transactions an hour. And because of its lack of acceptance, if you like, it's low use, it makes it much easier for the law enforcement authorities to track movement through it, even though its security and its capability for hiding transactions is very strong. Also, its usability is difficult. So Bitcoin's very, very easy to use, whereas some of these other cryptocurrencies like Dash and Zcash, they're quite hard to use, actually, which means you have to have a high level of technical capability. Also, groups like terrorists or, you know, serious organized crime groups, they're used to doing things in a very particular way. They understand how to move cash. They understand how to launder money. And although cryptocurrencies are going to help them in the future, there isn't a significant level of knowledge at the moment. And there is a suspicion around them. It's going to come. It's going to happen. But it really isn't there yet.
So in terms of blockchain, what does that mean?
Do you know, it's we see the word and all the term blockchain being thrown around for all manner of things. Actually, it is the simplest technology. Imagine a shoebox and you write all of your transactions on little bits of paper. So I tell you what, let's use the example of a trader in a market. And every time somebody pays him, he writes the little receipt and he puts it in a shoebox. And then about 10 minutes later, he puts the top on the shoebox and he locks it, and then puts another shoebox on top and starts putting all the transaction slips in that shoebox. Then after 10 minutes, he locks that shoebox and puts another one on top. So imagine these sort of shoeboxes piling up on top of each other. That is a very, very simple way of visualizing a blockchain. Transactions in a box which gets locked every 10 minutes in the example, for example, of Bitcoin. Now, the only difference is what something like Bitcoin does is it puts all the transactions over a 10-minute period in a box, but it then locks that box cryptographically. So it's very, very, very difficult to get inside that box and see the – well, that's – true, you can see the transactions in the box, but it's very, very hard to lock that box, unlock it, and then lock it again. Then you put another box on top in the example of Bitcoin, and when it locks that box, it uses the data from the transactions in that box and all of the transactions in all of the boxes underneath it. So if you wanted to go down 10 boxes and change one of the transactions, you'd have to recalculate the lock for every single box on top of it. It is literally a chain of boxes, a blockchain, which are connected together cryptographically. So actually, things like Bitcoin are extremely secure. And in fact, Bitcoin has never been undermined at all. All of the losses of Bitcoin and the thefts and that we hear about are really all from exchanges being hacked and socially engineered and things like that. Bitcoin itself is in fact extremely secure, and the blockchain system itself is extremely secure.
So that's a really profound point about the security of blockchain. But what about the ability to investigate, to monitor, to analyze activity on these sorts of technologies?
You have to remember that Bitcoin is open source. It uses a distributed ledger system. So that means that right now you or I can jump onto the internet and download a copy of every transaction that has ever happened on the Bitcoin system. It's completely open. You can see everything. What makes it pseudo-anonymous is that you send and receive Bitcoin to long strings of letters and numbers. And so they are not connected to an individual. So that makes it anonymous unless a investigator is able to use certain techniques to be able to out to the owner of that particular Bitcoin address or Bitcoin addresses. So there are a lot of tools out there now, a lot of commercial tools that do a super job for investigators. They're not perfect. And Bitcoin still provides what I would describe as pseudo anonymity and can be very anonymous if you know how to use it well.
Great. So thinking ahead, what would your advice be to law enforcement agencies to ensure that they have the skills and capabilities for the future?
I am banging the drum of training at the moment. And I don't mean training on the commercial tools. One of the problems that we always have within law enforcement is the time that officers have to be trained. So if we go back to computer forensics, and so computer forensics people use tools such as NCASE and Access Data's FTK, and it's very easy to teach somebody to use the tool. But if they don't know how the tool works, they're going to get themselves into trouble down the road. So when it comes to cryptocurrencies, it's vital that investigating officers understand first and foremost how cryptocurrencies work fundamentally, so that when they apply commercial tools to an investigation, they can truly understand the results that they're seeing. And that is absolutely vital. And we're helping with that. We teach a foundation class to law enforcement, and we've taught about 400 law enforcement officers now in just foundation cryptocurrency understanding and understanding how to investigate. And of course, we published a book in 2018 as well on the subject, which, as you mentioned in the introduction, is still the only book on the subject in the world at the moment. I think what's really interesting with terrorist use is, we talked about the reasons why they're not using it at the moment. The problem is they will, because terrorists are just criminals with a different mindset than someone that just wants to steal your money. But they're still criminals. And the reasons that they're not using it at the moment are, as we mentioned before, concerns over anonymity, depth of acceptance, usability, things like that. But those things will change. Their capabilities will change. Cryptocurrencies will catch up. And so law enforcement have to be all over it now, because we are going to see this creep into terrorism funding. It's quite interesting, actually. Somebody was a sort of mid-level drug dealer was arrested on the streets of London about 6 months ago. And intelligence showed that they had been, you know, doing quite large-scale drug deals out to the street dealers. And when the police arrested him, they expected to find a large amount of cash on him. They didn't. All they found was a mobile phone with access to £250,000 in cryptocurrency. And they realized that all the street deals were being done to the mid-level dealer through cryptocurrency. And that was really the first time we had seen that within street drug deals. So they're getting there. They're getting it. And we will see the same within terrorism funding. And I think for me, that's the key point. Let's get ahead of the curve right now, so that when we see the different terrorist groups, either lone wolf, bigger groups, whether it's for funding, whether it's for moving money, whether it's for laundering, whether it's for going through from normal organized crime into terrorism funding, we need to be ahead of that curve.
Brilliant. Thanks very much. And for listeners as well, I think it's important to point out some research we recently published on decentralized peer-to-peer social networks, because in some senses, there are some really profound parallels between the adoption of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies and the adoption of decentralized social media platforms. The similarities are just as you've expressed in terms of usability, security, and scale. And likewise with decentralized platforms, our assessment is there isn't currently a huge threat, but things are very likely to change in the near future.
There's another point on that, actually, if I can quickly make it, is messaging over blockchain systems. So the very first block that was ever mined with Bitcoin held a hidden message from Satoshi Nakamoto, quoting the Times of that day, bewailing the state of the banking system. And it's very easy to inject messages into the Bitcoin network, Bitcoin Cash network, Ethereum network, whatever it might be. And those are messages that you can never, ever, ever remove, because they are sat on a distributed network. And so micro-messaging is a very, very interesting area for law enforcement to be considering, because organized crime groups, terrorist groups could use blockchain systems in order to do really fairly anonymous messaging that can never be taken down by law enforcement or government. And again, although we're not seeing significant use, it is something we want to be ahead of the curve on.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much, Nick, for your contribution. Really appreciate
Pleasure.
That.
Lovely to speak to you.
Thanks,
guys.
Nick.
So if you want to follow Nick, he's on Twitter and his handle is NickFX.
So here to discuss how terrorists and violent extremists are fundraising as well as using new technologies to their advantage is Florence Keane. Florence is a research fellow at the International Centre for the Study of Radicalisation at King's College London. Florence, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So my first question would be, without money, terrorist groups cannot operate or sustain themselves. Can you tell us how terrorist organizations have been funding themselves pre and post 9/11? And perhaps you can shed some light on the methodologies used.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I think about terrorist groups, I think it's really important to be very clear about our categories, because as we all know, different terrorist actors have very different structures. And because of that, they have very different ways of financing. And I think it's great that you're making the distinction between pre and post 9/11 as well, because often people really think about 9/11 as ground zero. That's when we started trying to disrupt terrorist finances. But of course, terrorist groups were operating long before that. And of course, we were trying to prevent them from raising money. I think a useful way of thinking about groups is to split them into a few sort of simplistic categories. Beginning, I think, with your territory controlling group, obviously with Islamic State, that's really come much higher on the agenda in recent years. And with that, you'll have a group that very much controls land. It may vary in size, but of course, they have their own resources at their disposal. And in that regard, it may be using the land, it may be taxing people, natural resources. And the ability for the outside community to really disrupt them financially becomes very, very difficult. And in that regard, your kind of military strategy, trying to take as much land back as possible, is really important. So when people think about Islamic State, they spoke a lot about oil. But what was the biggest revenue generator for Islamic State was really the sort of taxation and extortion of local people, and really the kind of resources that they had at their disposal. So then another category that we would think about in terms of its revenue are sort of large transnational terrorist groups, often looking very similar to organised crime groups. And with that, I'd think about a group, for example, such as Hezbollah, who we know has quite sophisticated tactics to move money around the world, the use of money laundering schemes, the use of front houses, shell companies, and also this blend between organised crime as well. And in that regard, we may actually do better with treating them like an organised crime group and using our kind of anti-money laundering strategies. The use of sanctions, the use of asset freezes as well can often be quite a good strategy in trying to prevent a transnational group such as Hezbollah. Then, of course, we think about a group like Al-Qaeda, as I mentioned at the beginning. That was when really people thought, you know, terrorist financing came higher into the international agenda. And that group were able to move large sums of money through the formal financial system. The 9/11 Commission report reported around $300,000 to $400,000 that went completely undetected through the formal banking system. And with that, their fundraising strategies were the use of charities, the use of wealthy donors as well. Maybe some crime, but it really shocked the international community that so much money was able to move formally through the financial system. And on the back of that, we saw the Financial Action Task Force, which is the international standard setter for money laundering, adding terrorist financing to their mandate and really placing banks on the front line as doing more to detect suspicious activity, in particular terrorist financing. And the final category that I think becomes more and more relevant today, particularly for the West, is the lone actor or the small cell. And these come in different degrees. A lone actor or a small cell may have an affiliation to a group, they may be inspired, but often they really act very autonomously. And their primary goal is just to commit a quick terrorist attack if they particularly can't travel to another country as well. And there, when we think about financing, it's really low levels of money, if any money at all. So some of the recent attacks that have happened in the UK, think about Westminster Bridge, think about London Bridge, and others that we've seen in Europe. Simply someone needs to hire a van, maybe they want to use their own knife. The ability to really detect that through the formal system is limited because ultimately it probably isn't moving through the formal financial system. And they're trying to disrupt it may look much more like a financial intelligence approach, which I can talk about a bit later.
In light of these different categories you just mentioned, what has the global response been so far to counter this? And in your view, how successful would you rate these counter efforts?
So I would say it's been a relatively mixed bag. I think when we consider what the picture was like before 9/11, we have come a long way. So prior to 9/11, there was this convention, the 1999 Suppression Against Terrorism Financing Convention at the UN. But when 9/11 happened, only four countries in the world had actually moved to ratify it. The UK was one of them, which maybe makes sense in light of IRA. But not even a country such as the United States had moved to ratify this, which could be argued maybe no one was paying that much attention to depriving terrorists of funding. And 9/11 really did change that. And the Financial Action Task Force and its special recommendations on terrorist financing really drove up measures, and countries all around the world moved to prosecute and criminalise terrorist financing. So essentially the landscape has very much changed from that. But I think almost 20 years on from 9/11 happening, it's pertinent to consider whether or not we've actually stopped terrorists from moving money. Questions such as what does effectiveness look like, I think, haven't really been answered. Are we talking about the amount of assets frozen? Are we talking about the number of terrorist financing prosecutions or convictions? And if we are, then I think there's no country in the world that could really argue that they're particularly good at it. So I think there's something about our measures that are not particularly good. One place where the international community is good is if there's one common enemy, I guess. So the idea that we respond to the latest outrage. So back to Islamic State, when they really came on the scene and, you know, there were reports saying they were the richest terrorist group in the world. Most countries in the world kind of moved and formed a coalition against them financially and did all that they could to sort of take back that land and take back the money, which in its territory itself finally was successful. But when it comes to kind of more difficult terrorist financing problems, such as the lone actor that I've described, or even the transnational terrorist group that has sophisticated money laundering tactics, I don't know that we could say that globally we've been particularly effective. And I think part of that comes down to how it is that we frame the counter-terrorist financing regime. So policymakers and leaders will often say, you know, we need to do more to stifle terrorists of funding. We need to do more to cut it off as though it's water that can just be switched off and then the problem stops. But the reality is, if someone wants to commit a terrorist attack, whether small or large, Often they will find a way to do that, if not through the formal system, through the informal system, making use of the resources at their disposal. If it's a lone actor, maybe just making use of their salary. But that's not to say that a financial intelligence approach cannot work. So understanding counter-terrorist financing doesn't necessarily mean cutting it off at its source. It may be thinking about using financial intelligence throughout law enforcement to understand financial networks, to understand who it is that you're fighting. And there, I think we've seen more successes. And again, I can talk a bit more about this later, but there's been a greater move in recent years towards public-private partnership. And we've seen law enforcement actors and government really working with financial institutions and increasingly tech companies as well, social media, to try and get a better understanding of what terrorist financing looks like. And when we have both actors working together, I think that's where we can see some greater effectiveness.
So you would say that public-private partnership is probably the most effective tool in countering terrorism financing?
I think depending on what the threat looks like, it can be useful. I don't know if I would say it's the most effective. I think there are challenges as well. So depending on what country you're in, there may be restrictions as to what information you can share. And I think there are important questions that need to be had around data protection, around privacy, around upholding human rights when it comes to that. You know, in the UK, we have the legal gateway, Section 7, that we can share this information. But in many countries around the world, you wouldn't feel comfortable with governments and private sector sharing information. Maybe they don't have a strong record on human rights. Maybe they're anti-democratic. And there, I wouldn't necessarily advocate public-private partnership.
These are very good points. So obviously, we're talking about groups with different ideologies. So are there differences between the way Salafi jihadis and far-right groups, for instance, raise money?
It's a great question. I think the first thing to say is that when it comes to the far right groups, I think there's just been a real paucity in research, not just the finances, but actually just the ideologies itself. And I think in the last couple of years, that's really changing on the back of some of the big attacks that we've seen. It's important not to be too generic when we say Salafi jihadists and far right, and to try and frame them in terms of what kind of group are they and what their objectives are. If they're a larger group, again, they'll need more resources. Maybe they'll need to pay members or fighters if they're operating in a conflict zone, as we've seen some of the Salafi jihadists in recent years, all the way through to that kind of lone actor as well, which I've discussed. And we've seen more and more of those on the far right. But because there's this paucity of evidence, my old team at RUSI felt it was necessary to maybe investigate a bit further what we can see when it comes to far right and if there are kind of any differences and trends that may be useful to those that are trying to prevent terrorist financing. Again, it's important to make definitions clear. On the one hand, you'll have your kind of terrorist actor. So some of the lone actors in recent years, like Brenton Tarrant in New Zealand. We had Thomas Mayer, who killed Joe Cox MP. Darren Osborne, who drove a van into Muslim worshippers in Finsbury Park. And in that case, they're terrorists. You have a criminal justice response. But on the far right, of course, we have this kind of nebulous definition of extremism, some of which may not actually have a criminal justice response. So we think about figures like Tommy Robinson, who isn't necessarily doing anything illegal in terms of fundraising, but it's still kind of interesting to look at the typologies there. On the lone actor side, I think what's interesting is that often you see the far right actually moving to emulate some of the strategies of Salafi jihadists that they've seen as successful. So taking Darren Osborne, for example, and the use of a van, I mean, that's kind of textbook jihadist activity. And that was something that was really encouraged to jihadists who couldn't actually fight in Iraq and Syria. And that's extremely low cost. The ability to prevent that financially, I think, is extremely difficult. Thinking about Thomas Mayer, we know that he made some purchases prior to his attack to National Alliance, which is a US white supremacist group as well. But again, he was a lone actor. There was nothing in his past that had flagged anything as particularly suspicious. So you might argue that had we known something else about him and then seen that these purchases were being made, those two pieces of information could have been put together and could have been quite useful. Thinking about a group such as National Action, which was prescribed in the UK in 2016, is interesting because that was the first right-wing group, essentially, that was prescribed since World War II. And, you know, it wasn't a big group. There were, you know, roughly 60 to 80 members who didn't need too much money. There are suspicions that there was some kind of donation given or some kind of some inheritance money. But again, the finances of these groups were not large. They did some sort of low-level flyering campaigns at university before prescription. There were some plots that were disrupted, but again, not big sums of money. But back to the kind of thinking about emulation of tactics, Jack Renshaw, who's now been convicted, spoke about trying to conduct white jihad as well, which is kind of interesting to see how these ideologies may be borrowing from one another. And then just moving on to maybe some of the kind of far-right actors that aren't necessarily classed as terrorist actors. And then we think about conversations around crowdfunding and cryptocurrency, which we can talk about in more detail later. Mm-hmm. But I think some of the big figures, and particularly in the US, we know the Daily Stormer, which is a neo-Nazi site, and Andrew Anglin being the prominent guy there. He's spoken a lot about using cryptocurrency and has been known to... estimated to have amassed around $25 million, according to a cybersecurity analyst. His ability to actually cash out on that may not be the case, but still it's quite large sums of money. And in the wake of the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally, some analysis was done in terms of how much cryptocurrency he was receiving. Yeah. And there was a big donation that was tracked and it was given about $60,000. But what was interesting about this donation is it was 14.88 in its transaction, which is significant in so much as that is a neo-Nazi terminology. So 14 meaning the 14 words of David Lane, who's a white supremacist, and 88 standing for the eighth and eighth letter of the alphabet, HH, which is Heil Hitler. So it's pretty dark stuff, but often looking at numbers and looking at the kind of terminology, the important symbols to these groups can often tell you about intentions. Not that Andrew Anglin has been particularly conservative in his intentions, but again, we can discuss the kind of use of cryptocurrency and why that might be important to the far right in a bit.
So before we move on to cryptocurrencies and the use of cryptocurrencies by terrorist groups, but also the far right, let me just quickly go back to an article that you published last year. So it was... it was called Fundraising for Right-Wing Extremist Movements. And it was published by the RUSI Journal together with your colleagues Tom Keating and Kyla Isenman. So in this article, you were also highlighting that there is a current gap in current counterterrorism financing efforts, mainly because, correct me if I'm wrong, but most of or the majority of current efforts has solely focused on Salafi jihadist organizations rather than looking at the extreme right.
Yeah, I think that's the case. I do think it's changing, and I think it's understandable when, you know, particularly since, you know, 2014 and then the wave of terrorism that happened across Europe. As I said, the community is very good at responding to the latest outrage. And that's the purpose of terrorism, right? It works if we all kind of react and maybe we miss something else. I wouldn't necessarily argue that the threat from the far right is... more. I know that some of the kind of leading sort of security and counterterrorism police would argue that it's the biggest growing threat. If you look at some of the Prevent referrals, we see that really on the rise when it comes to the extreme right wing. And if you look at figures from the US, the actual number of domestic terrorist attacks from far right actors is higher than Salafi jihadists, which isn't necessarily the narrative that many would want you to believe. Yeah. So I think in terms of our counterterrorist financing efforts, arguably they have been really focused on Salafi jihadists. But at least from the UK perspective, I think it's been acknowledged that that needs to change.
So Florence, you also mentioned the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville and the donation of 14.88 bitcoins. So why are cryptocurrencies so popular among far-right groups?
It's a really interesting one. And I think part of it comes down to actually part of their ideology. Whereas maybe with the Salafi jihadist, it could be used as an opportunistic way of raising money. But when it comes to far-right actors, when we think about what it is that they believe, the idea of an international Jewish conspiracy, which often gets linked to Jewish people running the financial system, using a cryptocurrency may therefore be a kind of ideological way of avoiding the formal banking system.
So terrorist entities not only use cryptocurrencies, but have also exploited fintech platforms. Can you tell us a little bit about this and what has been done to counter this type of exploitation?
So I think when it comes to fintech, as I would also argue with cryptocurrency itself, is that we have to be quite balanced in how we state the risk. New technologies, I think, are always scary and we don't quite know how people would use them. And I would argue that both may present a risk. And, you know, we heard obviously with the Paris attacks, some use of prepaid cards. I understand that they do potentially pose a vulnerability, but I would still maybe argue that traditional methods are still the most used by terrorists at the moment. And I think there are a few reasons for that. When we think about virtual currency, there's obviously the element of volatility, the element of cashing out, and the fact that it's actually not anonymous, it's pseudonymous. And if you know what you're doing, you can trace it. When it comes to fintech companies as well, I think that there are a lot of smart people working in that industry at the moment who come from a tech background and are really trying to make sure that their platforms are secure. And there's initiatives, sort of public-private partnerships and private-private partnerships as well, that are really trying to kind of enhance knowledge and raise understanding about the potential money laundering and terrorist financing risks. One of which is the FinTech FinCrime Exchange, which some of your listeners may know of already. And this was an initiative that was founded 3 years ago, almost now, by FinTrail, a financial crime services consultancy company, and Roosie, which really tries to bring together different fintech platforms to discuss and analyse risk and kind of get in outside speakers as well to raise awareness on terrorist financing.
So, Florence, in your view, how can we reduce the risk of these fintech and also cryptocurrencies being exploited by terrorist or extremist entities?
So I think it really comes down to collaboration and understanding of the risk. So making sure that we're balanced in our risk assessment when it comes to cryptocurrencies. I think I and most others that have looked at this topic still feel the risk is relatively low of terrorists exploiting crypto. But that's not to say the risk won't change as currencies become more popular, but also certain coins become more privacy focused as well. So I think always kind of being on top of those risks, thinking about specific places where people might be more vulnerable, you know, where they may be able to cash out as well. But the more collaboration, the better. So initiatives back to public-private partnerships that can bring in kind of virtual currency exchanges as well into the conversation are really important. And finally, I guess, keeping on top of regulation. The Financial Action Task Force has really moved what they would call virtual assets under regulatory practices. So we look at Financial Action Task Force and the updated Recommendation 15, and also their guidance on providing a risk-based approach to virtual assets. And that can be really useful when thinking about people that need to deal with them. So from banks, supervisors, regulators, financial intelligence units in each country, and also just making sure that, you know, law enforcement all the way through to your prosecutors and judges are trained in understanding kind of virtual assets and fintech, how they may pose risks if someone uses them, how we can actually, you know, get a conviction, get a prosecution, I think are also really crucial elements as well.
Florence, thank you so much for your time. If you'd like to get in touch with Florence, you can follow her on Twitter. Her handle is @FlorenceKeen.
Joining us now is Andy McDonald, who's served over 30 years with the Metropolitan Police here in London. He retired in 2017 as head of Specialist Investigations of the UK National Terrorist Financial Investigation Unit at SO15, which is the Met's Counterterrorism Command in New Scotland Yard. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's great to be with you. Looking forward to chatting this morning.
So given your background and experience in countering terrorist finance, what's your view of how terrorist groups have evolved and adapted to new technologies such as cryptocurrencies?
Well, I think what we always have to think about is what is the threat that is? And understanding that threat is always the key to working out what they may then be either doing or not doing about certain things. And, you know, I think the law enforcement authorities and the security and the intelligence agencies very much react to the current intelligence picture, and then they perform their threat assessments from that. And I suppose since 9/11, and particularly 2011 focus onwards, it's pretty much been that 90% everything pointed at that radical Islamist threat. And we've learned an awful lot about what they do. And it's been very, very difficult. Certainly, when I was finishing my career, we were just leading up to the attacks that happened in London. We'd had the ones in mainland Europe, which were dreadful outcomes, something we'd never seen before. And I suppose when we looked at the individuals, we always tried to work out how have they come to this position where they're attacking potentially their own countries, doing these dreadful acts. And we looked at the radicalisation process. And it simply wasn't necessarily what historically had happened for people to become terrorists, where they would go off to camps, where they'd be sitting in madrasas, where they'd be sitting reading books, where they'd be sitting doing certain things. There was that online overlay about how people could become radicalised online, where they could get those concepts, those ideals, those mantra, simply by looking at their mobile or sitting looking at a screen online. And I think what we did was we pointed a huge amount of capability, capacity at managing that radicalist Islamic threat, which, you know, caused some dreadful outcomes over the past few years. And I always said for a number of years, we also always need to keep our eye on the other balls, whether that be mainstream AQ, military people, but particularly the extreme right wing and the IRA in the UK. And I think with those, some of those organisations, they have a different infrastructure. They have perhaps a degree of sophistication, a degree of hierarchy and of structure. Now, some of these people, I think, perhaps are thinking about funding the way they do business, organising themselves the way they do business, slightly differently to those perhaps lone wolf attack that we're going to talk about later on. So I think we should all have some expectation that both criminals and terrorists, because terrorists are criminals per se, the way they're going to adapt. And they always look at what are the authorities doing. They look at the way the police do their business. They look at the way the intelligence agencies do business. Of course, everything we do is out there and they understand it. Our struggle from the public and private sector perspective, trying to counter the various terrorist threats, never quite know what they're doing. So we're reliant on other sources of intelligence. But ultimately, everything is about understanding intelligence. And all we can do is, in terms of our threat assessment, is look at what the intelligence is available and then form perhaps the best options to manage and mitigate the various risks that come out of that. And things are constantly changing. So I think in terms of, you know, the question, you know, how do we do certain things? Well, we point at the current intelligence, and the current intelligence is still pretty much telling us from what we understand that 80-ish percent of the threat comes from radical Islamist threat, but an increasing threat, particularly in the UK, remains around the extreme right wing and potentially also developments within Northern Ireland. And we have to think about looking at those individuals, those groups, how are they becoming either further radicalised, but particularly how are they doing business, which causes a threat to the rest of us. So things change all the time.
And in terms of the use of internet technologies, how are terrorists and violent extremists using crowdfunding services, for example, or payment services online?
I think probably what we did see, particularly when we were looking at people perhaps who were travelling to those conflict zones back in 2014 to 2017, and when we're considering about people returning, which is perhaps the biggest threat to the UK and Western Europe, those who've been in conflict zones coming back, we looked at, you know, how did they get money to each other. And certainly the evidence that I came across, and I know still remains the case, is it's small amounts of money being transferred either by through either the Western Unions, the payment platforms, or perhaps fintechs that can deliver those payment platforms, so that it's not necessarily using the mainstream banking system, but at some point they still needed cash in hand. And what we did see was a lot of very small payments going out to areas surrounding the conflict zones, such as Turkey, where there were then facilitators who withdrew cash and or other payment instruments there that could then be used next door in the conflict zones. So we always keep an eye on that. And there's been a huge amount of brilliant work done by particularly the private sector, getting that intelligence, which can enable law enforcement to understand that risk and potentially identify those facilitators who are the ones who enabled quite a lot of people who travelled from all sorts of Western countries to get into Syria to then be part of that conflict. So payment systems, yes, I think we've actually gathered quite a lot of intelligence and a better understanding. When you move to some of the other things, so crowdfunding, yes, I'd heard of it. It wasn't something really that I'd experienced, certainly up to the time when I retired in 2017, but I know there are a couple of examples where crowdfunding potentially has ended up in the hands of terrorists. I think sometimes what we do see is that we see terrorist groups commit all sorts of financial crime, some of which goes to keeping their lifestyle going, their subsistence, as we might say, but then some of it might be actually physically used for a small amount of perhaps the preparation or the actual attack process itself. And as everybody knows, the challenges with terrorist financing is it tends to be really small amounts. It tends to be very, very difficult to spot. It tends to be very, very difficult to get to in time to say, actually, we can stop something happening. So, you know, the better informed we are, the better intelligence, understanding the threat is always, I think, the biggest challenge in terrorism, how things are going. If you then move on to cryptocurrency, I think probably your other speakers have said very much the same thing. Hasn't necessarily been experienced perhaps in the UK. We have seen, I know this year, Hamas talking about fairly significant amounts of Bitcoin. And I think the really, that type of funding of terrorism would be in those command and control organisations. You know, by that I mean things like Al-Qaeda, Hamas, perhaps Al-Shabaab, where they've got significant infrastructure where perhaps they can look at these alternative technologies. But what we need to focus on for the threat that exists, the threat that people are going to really hit us either in our own country or surrounding countries in the West, is we need to understand the individuals, the organisations and the funding that keeps them going so that we can manage them and have the security we need to make sure that we can stop them doing stuff in the first place.
So shifting perspective a little bit onto smaller platforms, smaller fintechs, how does regulation work in this area and what do those smaller players need to know?
But one of the things that I would have said, yeah, if we had to change anything, you know, what do we have to do? Well, law and regulation, particularly in the financial crime arena, has been nothing but change, probably the last 5 or 6 years. We've certainly got, if you look at in the EU, we've got the fifth anti-money laundering directives, which does give insights on how new cryptocurrencies should be regulated. But then all of the individual jurisdictions themselves have different views about how much of an impact cryptocurrency is going to be on mainstream crime, let alone terrorist financing. So getting everybody to a place where they have pretty much the same idea about the regulation of cryptocurrency, the regulation of financial platforms, the regulation of the fintechs, which perhaps enable those various transactions to take place, is something that is a huge, huge challenge. I think the more we talk about it, the more we can get into the public forums, whether it be FATF, whether it be people like yourselves, Europol doing some great work pulling together both public and private sector together. But again, we're in a position where various jurisdictions have a completely different view about what cryptocurrency does, both in terms of pros and cons. And until we get to a place where actually there's global recognition of this is what ought to be happening, it's different. I mean, even this week, we've had the position where the cryptocurrency is suddenly being looking at potentially as criminal property. So if we're thinking about removing cryptocurrency from criminals, potentially in the future, we're going to have a much better traction around that. But it's not quite yet. So I think we're very much in a learning position, still in its infancy, the understanding in terms of what cryptocurrency is, what some of these technical payment systems actually are. And that's without then thinking about if they're being used criminally, how do we go about that? How do we go about evidencing that criminality and then stopping people from doing it? So it's a huge, huge challenge, albeit because it's in a technology and things like blockchain, everybody thinks is impossible to evidence. Actually, we're beginning to understand how to do that. But the only way we do that is the people who truly understand it, the people who truly work in that environment, work with law enforcement to help them do that particular process.
All right. And for the benefit of listeners, FATF means the Financial Action Task Force.
So apologies. Yeah, acronym central. Yes. Financial Action Task Force, who are globally give guidance for all the various financial institutions and for law enforcement to help everybody understand what we can do to counter both anti-money laundering and terrorist financing.
So how does it work in terms of practically sharing typologies and threat intelligence between the large financial players and the smaller ones? And also, you know, how is law enforcement involved with this? Because it seems partly about developing a mechanism to share information.
Well, without intelligence, it doesn't matter whether you're in the public or private sector, you can't get your business as usual done. It is as simple as that. In the law enforcement environment, if we haven't got an intelligence picture to suggest we ought to be pointing our resources at a particular threat, we can't do it legally, we can't do it morally, and we can't do it ethically. So we need an intelligence picture. And I suppose as I grew up over 30 years, the police were always in that position. You think, OK, something's going to happen, the police will sort that out. But we always needed intelligence. We've only really articulated intelligence-led approaches over the last 20, 25 years and saying, well, we need that intelligence to do stuff. So it comes back to where did the intelligence come from? Well, from a law enforcement perspective, it's either something that you react to and it's happened and you learn, or perhaps it could have been old school informants might give us information, or just members of the public letting law enforcement know that this sort of stuff's happening. And then we had the private sector running their businesses, trying to make profit, trying to provide services for people. And they would always also rely on intelligence. But they think about it in a different way to perhaps the public sector was thinking. And from my perspective, perhaps one of the greatest things that I was a part of for the final 5 years of my services was Joint Money Laundering Intelligence Task Force, the GIMLET. That's where you actually got the law enforcement, the intelligence agencies, people from the public sector, sitting with those who actually owned all of the financial intelligence from banks, money transfer agents, smaller banks, not just about the big banks, people in the less regulated sector, and also people like yourselves and Roosie and others, all sitting round actually talking about what the threats were. And what you'd find out was that law enforcement had one perspective, private sector would have a slightly different perspective, but we were all going in exactly the same direction. But historically, we hadn't actually spoken to each other. Now, it's at forums like the Joint Military Intelligence Task Force that typologies can be discussed. One bank might see, we're seeing a particular problem, perhaps with fraud or with potential money laundering in this. And what you'd find is that there'd be other people in the room saying, actually, we're seeing something very different, or actually, we're seeing something quite similar or exactly the same. And that's when you can start thinking about, well, if we have enough intelligence to suggest there's a new threat, we can begin to react to that. Historically, that didn't exist. And I certainly do remember in the infancy of the Gimlet that legal barriers was always one of the things that was discussed. Now, we have Crime and Courts Act 2013, and the National Crime Agency have been in a position where we can facilitate the exchange of financial intelligence. It's always got to be with a view to preventing and detecting particularly serious and terrorist crime. But there are options available where banks can, on intelligence, which historically say we could never share that, actually there's a capability now that through the right channels, that intelligence can be shared with the appropriate people so that there's a better understanding of the threat picture that exists. So that's great. Also forums like yourself, people talking, people suddenly realising, yeah, we've got a speaker talking about that and we're seeing something similar. For somebody to be able to coordinate that activity to make sure the intelligence gets the right people is something that I only really seen developing over the last 4 or 5 years. And it's all really, really positive. But just remember, the bad guys don't have to go through all these processes. They just see a potential issue. They gather what they need to do intelligence and they do something. They don't have meetings. They don't have laws. They don't have regulations. They don't have a load of other meetings to go to. They don't have to get funding for stuff. They just do things. And it's why we're always behind the curve. And it's why we need to continually work together just to keep pushing the various boundaries that we think might be legal sharing boundaries to make sure the right people have got the intelligence to get that really important action done.
So, Andy, in terms of the legal framework in the UK, what are the differences between extremism and terrorism?
That's still the biggest challenge, actually. Proving somebody is a terrorist. So for terrorist funding, to prove if sections 15 to 18 of the Terrorism Act, you have to prove that the funding was for a terrorist purpose. So that's always a challenge. If you think of Jack Letts and his parents and those sort of issues, that funding that they sent to Jack out in Syria was for a terrorist purpose. Their argument was, actually, no, it's to enable him to get home. It wasn't for the terrorist purpose. So that's always a challenge in itself. But then we've also got all of the other issues at the moment is people can be extremists and have extreme views and say really extreme things which might enable other people to commit dreadful acts. But funding extremism and extremist views is not at the moment an offence.
Andy, great. Thank you very much for your expertise today. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
And for listeners wanting to get in contact with Andy, he's on LinkedIn and happy to respond to any questions you might have. Thank you to our guests Florence Keane, Nick Furneaux and Andy McDonald. We'll be back soon with another episode. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Tech vs Terrorism.